they phoned me and said, hey, would you be interested in meeting us for lunch? Well, that lunch turned into a very long lunch and then a very long dinner. And by the end of the night, you know, for me, it was what a great opportunity to really come full circle. And sometimes you got to go around the globe to come back home. And in my heart of hearts, I'm looking forward to the next 10 years.
Welcome to the storm. Host Stuart Winchester, bringing you the second of many DC podcasts that I have scheduled for 2024. First, though, thank you to all of my paid subscribers to the Storm Skiing Journal and Podcast. You are helping to ensure the future of independent ski journalism that is about more than stoke and bro culture. The Storm is a sustainable small business because of you and your ongoing support. If you are still on the free tier and are considering an upgrade to paid, the benefits include access to podcasts 7 full days before free subscribers and 100% of all Storm Skiing Journal articles. If you are just seeing the article previews right now, you're missing 80% or in some cases even more of the Storm's content. If you are not signed up for the Storm at all, free or paid, you can do that at stormskiing.com. You can also follow the Storm on the X platform or Instagram at Storm Ski Journal. All right, let's talk about my partner, the fractional marketing experts at Bonfire Collective. Does your marketing need a fresh perspective from industry experts? Better storytelling, rebranding, advertising. Let me introduce you to Bonfire Collective, a fractional marketing team that collaborates with ski areas and outdoor brands. What does that mean? It means that Bonfire can help you rethink your approach in ways that can turbocharge your business. Bonfire Collective took over the marketing at one New Hampshire ski area and doubled revenue in just 3 years. To get started, you will want to talk to Eric over at Bonfire Collective. Eric was a co-founder of Bluebird Backcountry, the first human-powered downhill ski area, and so he knows the ski business. You can see what Bonfire Collective can do for your ski area and reach out to Eric at thebonfirecollective.com. Episode 169, Steve Pacagnan, President and CEO of Panorama BC. Okay, do you want the hack? Do you want to know how to get Rocky Mountain quality snow without Rocky Mountain crowds and Rocky Mountain price tags? Do you want a modern big mountain alternative with updated lifts that doesn't involve flying to Europe? Do you want access to funky ski towns with the option to stay right at the mountain? The hack is right there. The hack is obvious. The hack is British Columbia. There's a reason I'm hitting BC so hard this year and why I'm putting it first on the Storm's growing coverage of Canada. The province is home to some of the best skiing in the world and has widely adopted US-based multi-mountain passes without latching on to the worst tendencies of US-based operators and NIMBY communities. By that, I mean accessing and staying at the mountains is still relatively attainable for a person with an average income. And that is mostly because BC operators, unlike so many US ski areas stuck in legal purgatory, can actually build beds on and near their mountains. And almost no one has more experience getting things done in BC than my guest today, who has led Panorama on its quiet evolution into one of the best family ski areas in North America. If you don't get it yet, you will after you hear this conversation. Let's go. My guest today has been president and CEO of Panorama Resort in British Columbia since 2013. With a 4,265-foot or 1,300-meter vertical drop, Panorama offers one of the longest continuous lift-served ski descents in North America. The ski area covers nearly 3,000 acres of terrain, served by 10 lifts and 2 snowcats. Prior to taking the top job at Panorama, he spent 6 years as president and general manager of Kicking Horse, British Columbia. He is also a prior general manager of Copper Mountain, Colorado, and the Mount St. Marie ski area in Quebec, and first started at Panorama in the winter of 1985 to 86. Steve Pacagnan is my guest. Steve, welcome to the Storm. I am so glad we can make this one happen. How are you doing today, Steve?
Great, Stuart. And thanks again for having me today.
It's my pleasure. So I got to start with the 2023 to 24 ski season. I know everyone had a little bit of a slow start, but it seems like things got cranking eventually. How's things going for you there at Panorama?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting winter, no doubt, across North America, but things are going exceptionally well here. We have invested an incredible amount in snowmaking over the last 10 years. Panorama's been a snowmaking resort since the early 80s, but you know, the last 10 years, we've put in, you know, well over $7 million in snowmaking and just shy of 400 snow guns out there in a fully automated snowmaking plant. And we started to watch what was happening when the weather gurus start talking about the winter ahead. And you know, we made a conscious effort to probably produce more than we normally would during our production window. But we started on time in early October, and with those investments and efficiencies, we were able to actually produce more snow in a shorter window with 3 degrees warmer temperature and be on snow for early season race training November 1st and open to the public on December 8th. And Mother Nature also came through. We were lucky to get about 2 feet of fresh snow on the day before we opened, which is fantastic.
You know, Steve, I think some folks, given where you're located on the Powder Highway, may be surprised to hear how reliant you are on snowmaking. I mean, you're jammed there between Fernie, pretty snowy, Kicking Horse, pretty snowy, Revelstoke, really snowy. Do you have a sense for why Panorama doesn't get the natural snow necessarily that those other Powder Highway resorts do?
Well, I think we're blessed with quite a bit of natural snow, but, you know, the resort started off with a snowmaking system, which was a conscious investment back in the late 70s and 80s, and they just continue to grow from there. And, you know, the investment in snowmaking for us has just been an absolute game changer. In today's world, it's insurance. You know, when I had the opportunity to come back here some 11 years ago, we were, I think, around, you know, 80 snow guns in the field, and decided to really, you know, position ourselves to be open very early for race training, which brings international teams from all over the world here. And, you know, we've become very much reliable and infamous for having early season race training. So, you know, I looked at it some 10, 11 years ago and said, look, we're going to be exceptionally good at having snow early. We're going to be exceptionally good at grooming, positioning ourselves as really, you know, having exceptional grooming. So I actually just ordered another 50 guns. So we're just shy of 400 snow guns in the field. You know, fully automated plant. We have the, you know, the incredible blessing of having a river, a glacial river that comes through the resort here. So we're able to draw water out of that river. And we're now the largest Prenov fleet of cats in Canada. We've got 10 cats, four of which are winch cats. And then something really interesting and differentiated is in the high alpine, where we've got Tate and Bowl, about 1,000 acres of skiing in a natural bowl. We have two passenger cats now that we operate. One's called Jekyll and the other one's called Hyde. And we've named the terrain the monster terrain. It's big mountain terrain, so we call it the monster terrain. So that's been, you know, an interesting evolution over the last 10 years. But snowmaking for us, yeah, I think it's critical. We face north. We're about 4,000 feet base elevation, just shy of 9,000 feet in the upper alpine. And so, you know, all of those core elements coming together of temperature, north facing, water, and just continuously investing in snowmaking is really paying dividends for us.
I mean, 4,265 vert, that's no joke. How high up the mountain do you actually go with your snowmaking plant?
Well, we go to about 3,600 feet, more or less. So there's three quads to the summit. Two high-speed quads take us to about three-quarters of the way up the mountain, and that's as high as snowmaking goes for us. Above that, you know, we're getting a lot of natural snow, and so that, you know, that's really working well in our favor. So the areas where we need it is really up to, you know, that second quad called the Champagne Quad, and then, you know, from there down the mountain into key areas, and it's really, again, been a game changer for us to have that expansion of snowmaking.
Those 50 guns you just referenced, Steve, are those replacing older technology? Are those going on an all-new run that doesn't have snowmaking now? What's your plan for those? What can you tell us about where you're going to put them?
Yeah, no, it's a combination of both. So some of the early innovations that we had here at Panorama, just going back to the mid-80s, there was a fellow here that actually joined our snowmaking team, came from the prairies in Canada here, and he was a machinist and really was fascinated by snowmaking and just thought he could actually produce a more efficient gun, which he did, and the gun was called the McKinney. We are into our phasing out the last of those guns, so it's a blend of phasing out some of those and then layering in some more in some key areas where we really focus on early season race training and races. In fact, today we're fully set up for the North American Championships. They start this weekend here and we'll run for 10 days. And having them this late in the season, you know, some may say that could be a challenge, but we're not having a challenge at all because of the snowmaking that we have here. And having that solid base is just really been important for us to be able to actually host that event at this time of year.
Do you still make your own guns or do you work with an outside vendor now?
No, we rely on the pros out there and there's, you know, great vendors. I mean, they're all exceptional. We've got a blend here of Technolopin and HKD. So some, you know, fans and air water guns. And then, you know, the physical plant is, you know, pumps and compressors. But through the advances in technology, we've been able to back off from four compressors down to one with a booster compressor if and when we need it. So we're now really in a position where the efficiency is really high. You know, if we were manufacturing, the product coming out the door is exceptionally efficient in terms of quantity and quality. And there's little waste on the plant floor, so to speak, if you were sort of comparing it to manufacturing.
So it sounds like you're constantly improving the mountain. I think that Panorama's profile has been growing for a while now. And a lot of people in particular have probably become aware of the mountain since you joined the Icon Pass. This is your second full season, Steve, in that coalition. How happy are you so far with being a member of the Icon Pass?
We're exceptionally happy with the Icon Pass. It really has opened up new market for us in the U.S., that combined with the Mountain Collective Pass. And then, you know, you look at the experience that those guests are getting coming to this part of Western Canada. It really, truly is a ski safari. You know, we are joined with Lake Louise and Sunshine and Revelstoke and Sun Peaks a little further to the west of us. That's been exceptional. And then, you know, you've got Red Mountain a little further south of us in the West Kootenays, which is a great resort, and Schweitzer Basin, now owned by Alterra and part of that Icon Pass. So it really creates an interesting road trip, safari, part of that Powder Highway experience. And, you know, with the Mountain Collective Pass, we call it the True Order of the North. So I think it's opening up a vast market out of the U.S. to this part of Canada, you know, great flights into Calgary for people to come and experience and discover it. And yesterday I had the fortunate opportunity to be out heli-skiing. We've got RK heli-skiing right out of the heart of the resort here and met a number of folks from the U.S. that were either on the Mountain Collective or on the Icon Pass. So it's been phenomenal. Really, really happy with it and happy with the great resorts that are part of both Mountain Collective and Icon. Just a great collection of resorts and, more importantly, the people. Just getting to know, you know, my peers and the CEOs and the marketing people and CFOs out there. It's just a phenomenal group of people.
One thing that's always defined Panorama, Steve, is that it was big and uncrowded. And the Icon Pass has a mixed reputation for contributing to crowding. Curious how much you thought about that and how much of a factor that was in you considering whether or not to join the Icon Pass and whether that was the right product for Panorama. And then have you seen more people coming from it and are the crowds still manageable?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing is the crowds are absolutely manageable, and the feedback that I hear all the time when I'm chatting with either Icon guests or Mountain Collective guests is, aside from the natural beauty of being in the Purcells and the Rocky Mountains of this part of Canada, is the crowds are a little different than what they experience in different parts of the U.S. and other areas. But, you know, for us, it's really, we're not going to be an overly crowded resort. And it's the reason being is it's not because it's unpopular. It's really about access. The access is excellent in terms of driving to the resort. But as you know, in Canada here, we don't have the population or the critical mass that our great neighbors and friends next door have in the U.S. So there's less population, which I think is a huge advantage. And just the amount of air traffic in Canada. I mean, we don't have an open skies policy. So there's not a lot of competing airlines. You've got a couple. Air access is excellent. It's phenomenal, you know, into portals like Calgary or Vancouver and Kelowna, even Cranbrook, just to the south of us here. Really no issue there. It's just, you know, critical mass. So I think the advantage is, you know, you've got that experience where you've got a lot of skiable acres, and skiers per acre is a lot less. But the overall experience, access, getting to us, it's well worth it. And I would say the same for all of, you know, the resorts here in Western Canada.
So it sounds like you're maintaining that good experience. At the same time, I imagine that you hoped that signing with Ikon would bring in more skiers. I'm curious, as your neighbors on the Powder Highway, Fernie, Kimberley, Kicking Horse, all part of the Epic Pass, Revelstoke, Red Mountain were part of the Ikon Pass, Whitewater still sort of hanging out by itself. But did you feel pressure to join one of these multi-mountain passes? Did you feel like you were losing business to these other mountains and you needed to do this to stay alive as a business or at least to stay competitive?
Well, certainly didn't feel the pressure to do that and certainly didn't feel the need to do it to stay competitive. Like, we've actually been partnered with Lake Louise on their pass for a number of years, and we've got a car product out there. And so I didn't feel that pressure, but I just thought it was time. You know, for me, it resonated well with Mountain Collective being one and the other one with Ikon in terms of the group of resorts, having Lake Louise and Sunshine and certainly Revelstoke all within really close proximity to each other. I think that really made sense. And, you know, yes, absolutely. It certainly has opened up more market for us out of the U.S. We've seen those numbers increase year over year, and that's been exceptional. In terms of the other resorts, you know, they made a conscious choice to go with, you know, the other pass, and that's great. And I think for all of us, it really has started to open up a new market or a growing market out of the U.S. And I think more people are starting to discover this part of North America, and there's just so much to offer in terms of great resorts, vertical acreage, skiers per acre is a lot less. And then given that we're right here in either it's the Selkirks or the Monarchies, the Purcells, the Rocky Mountains, even the, you know, the side country experience out of these resorts is exceptional. And then the heli and Catskiing operators and those operations are some of the best in the world in this part of the country. So folks with, you know, those passes, Ikon, Mountain Collective are also experiencing that. They're bolting that on to their ski safari experience. And like I said, yesterday I was out skiing with RK Heli Skiing. It was a phenomenal day, great experience, and chatted with a number of folks on those passes. And they've been at the resort, they've been here at Panorama, but they'd also done a safari. They'd gone to Revelstoke, they went to Red Mountain, Lake Louise Sunshine. So I think that is just a great experience for those that haven't had the opportunity to head north and come into this part of Canada.
As someone who ran Kicking Horse for a long time, how do you feel about maybe picking up an Epic Pass too so you can hit both and just make it a really big adventure?
Well, why not? I mean, again, you know, the number of phenomenal resorts here in Western Canada, if you can bundle up a number of different passes and come and experience them, I would say go for it.
Gosh, the possibilities are awesome in this current environment we have. So, you know, Steve, I want to focus on those international visitors for a moment. We're kind of getting back to normal, at least from my point of view, and you probably have better data on this that can say for sure what it looks like. But you were isolated from the United States for a couple of winters. And for folks who aren't familiar with where Panorama is, I mean, you're really close to the United States. You're one of the closest Canadian resorts in BC to the lower 48. Just thinking back on that time. How much does Panorama historically count on visitors from the U.S. and from other countries? I think BC gets a lot of overseas visitors as well. What were these years like when they went away, and how have you been recovering?
Yeah, I mean, we've relied on a destination market out of Australia, New Zealand, some from the U.S. and the U.K., different parts of Europe because of the heli skiing in this area. When, you know, COVID came, we all thought, oh boy, you know, what does this mean and where are we going as an industry? But It was, aside from the realities of that and certainly how we all were impacted by it as an industry, and certainly for Panorama in this part of Western Canada and Canada, there was an interesting phenomena. And I think the industry as a whole has seen a rebirth or certainly some growth coming out of it, because what else could we do? I mean, there was not a lot we could do indoors in terms of sport or gathering. So getting outside, I think, was really important for our, you know, physical and mental well-being. And what better place to go than, you know, a ski area or a cross-country area and just getting outside. So we saw a lot of people come back to the sport. Really, the regional market was where we saw people reconnecting with the mountains and reconnecting with the sport, alpine and cross country, snowshoeing, getting out on fat bikes, all that sort of stuff. Just getting outdoors and coming to the mountains again, I think was, you know, important. But we also saw growth, you know, coming out of that. So it was an interesting phenomena. And, you know, we certainly wanted to continue to build upon that. So making sure that we connected with folks when they bought passes and starting to really communicate with them more and more. So that has continued. And I think for the industry as a whole, it has actually continued.
So with the borders back open, and that's been awesome. I was actually able to get up to BC and do a little skiing myself this winter. But have you seen a return to the mix that you saw before COVID? In other words, are you seeing a percentage of US visitors, New Zealand visitors, Australian visitors that you would have seen pre-COVID? Or has that kind of changed both with COVID, with Canadians maybe discovering how good it is close to home, and then maybe the Icon and Mountain Collective Pass is contributing to that as well?
Yeah, certainly seeing things return back to normal. That has happened. And in the same breath with staff, there is a point in time where it was really, really challenging. But it's great now to see, you know, not only the international guests coming back to the resort, but certainly seeing that mix of international employees coming back to the resort. We're now at full capacity in terms of staff from all parts of the globe, which is great to see. You know, the one thing, you know, just sort of looking back at big events in history, you know, whether it was, 9/11, SARS, H1N1, the financial crisis of 2008, the one thing I've observed is people go back to the mountains. There's a connection with the mountains. I think people feel it's a place to go back to when there's tough times. And we certainly saw that, you know, through COVID and post. And there's been a reconnection, I believe, with, you know, people coming back into the mountains. So we're seeing some really solid growth. And as I said, on the employee front, it's great to be back to some incredibly solid numbers with some amazing people.
So that's good from a business point of view, Steve. I'm curious from a cultural point of view about the energy that brings when you have folks from all over the world that are congregating on this one spot in remote British Columbia. You know, how nice is it to get that back and just filling that gap that was left when it was, you know, pretty much anyone who was just there was stuck there?
Yeah, I think for all of us in the industry, it's a great feeling to have that back. And, you know, having the mix of folks from not only Canada, but from all over the world brings a vibrancy. It brings an energy. Youth mobility, I think, is important. I mean, they're here to have a great experience as well. Their experience is just as important as our guest experience. We're fortunate in that we have employee housing, and I know many areas are working hard to expand their employee housing or bring employee housing into their areas or into their communities. So I think that's great. It's fantastic. It's critically important. We've had that here for the past 20 years. And so, you know, being able to fill that and certainly work with our local community of Invermere and the Columbia Valley to have people reside down there in the wintertime as well has been good. Now, that being said, we are looking to our future. And the one thing about Panorama Mountain Resort and the way we're structured is we own all of our real estate and developable land, fee simple. We've got about 200 acres yet still to develop. And there's absolutely a portion of that land that is solely dedicated for future staff housing and in the expansion of staff housing. So as I look to our future and looking at the master plan, which is just sitting on the desk here with me today, employee housing is a big part of our future as well, expanding upon that as we continue to grow.
I mean, it must be so wild to think about how much that ski area has changed since you first started to work there in 1985. And that's one of the reasons I was so excited for this interview, Steve, is I talk to a lot of folks who run big mountains, but some of them don't necessarily have that institutional knowledge and they've been there for a year or two and that's great. And that's not to say that they're not completely capable of the job, but they just don't have it in their bones in the way that someone like you does, who really showed up a long time ago and has watched that evolution firsthand. Can you take us back here, Steve? Like I said in the intro, 1985, you showed up. What did Panorama Mountain look like when you got there in the mid-80s?
Well, in the mid-80s, it was actually rather fresh and new. Although it was, you know, if you go back in time, it was about 1962 when it really started to come together as a ski area. And there were years prior to that where as a small ski club, there were things happening in and around Panorama. And there's some history there. But, you know, in the mid-80s, it was actually rather fresh and new. The ownership at the time was a gentleman out of Calgary who was in the energy sector and quite a diversified entrepreneur. And he had bought the resort in the early 80s and started developing it. So at that time, the summer, you know, tennis was huge. There's a legacy of 5 tennis courts on the resort today. And certainly, you know, another aspect of it, and not unlike many other areas, timeshare was a really big deal. It allowed young families to be a part of a mountain resort and to own a part of something in a mountain resort. So that was big. There was about 265 townhome and condos built in what we call the Lower Village, a subdivision of single family homes that were the early adopters from the early 70s, and then lift infrastructure that had gone in, some chairlifts, still had the big T-bar, which is now the Mile One Quad, and a new hotel at the time called the Pine Inn. So It was fresh and exciting when I first came here. And more importantly, the people, just, you know, the energy at that time. I was young. There was a lot of young people at the resort. I think the ownership was excited about what they had invested in the resort. And coming to it, I thought it was just absolutely amazing. The big thing, you know, for me, I grew up in Vancouver on the West Coast and spent a lot of time learning to ski as a kid on the North Shore Mountains, whether it was Cypress or Grouse Mountain or Seymour, and then doing the big weekend trips up to Whistler. But, you know, coming here and just the awe-inspiring mountains, you know, the Rocky Mountains and the Purcell Mountains was an instant connection. That combined with this, what I thought was really vibrant and exciting resort.
What drew you there, Steve? Did you, because in the 80s, you couldn't just look it up on the internet, right? Did you take a trip out there? Did you have a buddy? Like, what, how did you end up on the Eastern side?
Yeah, well, started my first year of university, first semester, and had a number of friends that took off that summer and came into the Rocky Mountains and worked at a number of different hotels and resorts, you know, from Jasper all the way down to Banff. And at that time, a number of those places would actually close in the winter, and Panorama was quite innovative. They would go and recruit from a number of the Fairmont hotels, Springs and Chateau Lake Louise and Jasper Park Lodge, and a number of friends got recruited to come to Panorama, and you stay in touch in one way, shape, or form, certainly no cell phones, and they said they were at this resort called Panorama, and I should come and check it out. First break of the semester, jumped on a Greyhound, came out here, and it was, I think within 24 hours, I just fell in love with it. You know, looking at the mountains, they were awe-inspiring, these young people having a great time. I grew up skiing in the mountains, and it just felt right. There was a connection emotionally, spiritually, and just being around a lot of young people the same age, and and felt it was something that I really wanted to do. You know, friends said, look, you can start working tomorrow if you want. Got a job as a bellhop in the Pine Inn. I think it was $3.25 an hour at the time. Jumped back on the Greyhound, went home, sat with my parents and said I had this amazing job. They weren't quite convinced it was the right thing to do, but they were very, very supportive, amazing parents. And I came back on the Greyhound and jumped right into it, just fell in love with it.
How about the skiing, Steve? Growing up on coastal BC, conditions can be super variable. You get more consistencies there in the Rockies. Just talk about the quality and sort of consistency of the skiing in the two regions and why, because I think a lot of folks who grew up skiing Vancouver end up going up to Whistler, right? That's sort of the natural progression, but you did went in the other direction. So what was it about the skiing itself that drew you to it?
You know, the one thing I'll say is growing up on the West Coast, sure, it's different, but you learn to adapt. And there are some amazing days, whether it's on the North Shore Mountains or, you know, certainly up in Whistler, but you learn to adapt. I think coming here, certainly the snow was, you know, you sort of move into a region that really is consistent in terms of powder. So you learn to ski that. And I remember being out there on a pair of Castley skis that were, I think they were 210s or 212s and very narrow, trying to sort of maneuver the powder. But I think the other thing was the vertical, just the amount of vertical that was awe-inspiring. When you get higher into the Alpine, just the views of, you know, the Rockies and the Purcells. And the other thing is the amount of sunny days, the sunshine, you know, we're consistently getting, you know, a lot of sunny days. So I thought that was a stark difference, you know, growing up in a coastal city where, you know, in the city itself, you can get, you know, a tremendous amount of rain in the wintertime. So I think having that much sunshine was a big differentiator as well.
So it sounds like you settled in pretty well and got to know the place. Then in 1993, IntraWest comes in and purchases Panorama. And this is just such an interesting part of ski history with American Skiing Company and IntraWest in the 1990s. I realize you were in a more junior role at the time, but you still were there to witness it all happening. What were your impressions of IntraWest and what their impact on Panorama could be when you first heard the news that they were going to buy your resort?
Sure. Well, I'm going to go back a little bit in time. I had the opportunity to go study ski resort management at Selkirk College in Nelson, British Columbia, which is if anybody is thinking about wanting to further their career in the ski industry, Selkirk College in Nelson is absolutely a phenomenal college when it comes to understanding the ski industry. And the support of the industry as a whole is really behind that program. Anyway, I had the opportunity to go there, and IntraWest was relatively young at that time, and I was fascinated with what they were doing at Blackcomb Mountain. Folks like Hugh Smythe and others, you know, were really pioneering something brand new with Blackcomb. So I was, as a young business student, in awe of this and just absorbing everything I could get my hands on to read and understand what they were doing there, and certainly understand what IntraWest was doing. So when they decided to buy Panorama, it was one of the first resorts, along with Tremblant, that they had purchased outside of Blackcomb, starting to grow the stable of resorts and, you know the rest of the story. But it was exciting. Just an incredible group of people, some bright minds. And they worked really closely with some amazing planners, EcoSign mountain planners. They'd actually been involved with Panorama since the late 70s. Paul Matthews and that group had been involved with helping master plan Panorama, but it really went to another level when that group got re-engaged here and started to look at what the full potential of the resort could be. You know, the interesting thing is, you know, I'm sitting here today with the master plan, you know, from about 93 to when they really started to execute on the plan proper, which would have been in the late 90s. You know, I'm still using the foundational pieces of that master plan from that time. And credit goes to EcoSign and certainly IntraWest. And, you know, we've certainly tweaked and evolved it, but you know, all those foundational pieces are still there today. So it was exceptional. I mean, the birth of the Upper Village, the condo hotels, the Springs Pools, which is iconic, you know, one of the highest Springs Pools in certainly in Canada at the resort here, putting in the village gondola, which connected that lower mountain village that I spoke about earlier with those 265 condo hotels and the tennis courts and all of that. And really as a people mover, it, there was 97 metal stairs that used to take you from the lower village to the upper village. But that people mover today, you know, connecting the lower village and the upper village was part of that era. And then starting to look at lift infrastructure as well, putting in, you know, high-speed quads and certainly starting to connect the higher alpine even more with the rest of the resort, expanding some snowmaking at the time. You know, all of those things I think were absolutely a great legacy that IntraWest left Panorama.
So IntraWest brought big changes. The first thing they did was a small change. It was actually a pretty big deal for skiing, which was, or one of the first things they did was install a T-bar to the summit. Having been super familiar with the mountain at that point, how much did that lift change the character and status of Panorama and the way people thought about and skied the mountain? I realize you needed a lot of lifts to get up there, but still having a lift to the summit's a big deal, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, well, one thing is once you're up there, you know, keep talking about the views and Stuart, we got to get you here because you'll see it firsthand, but the 360 degree views from the summit are phenomenal. You're looking east to the Rocky Mountains. You can see Mount Assiniboine, which is quite symbolic. And then as you come around to the west, you know, Mount Nelson, which is iconic. And there's, you know, something that we call View of 1,000 Peaks. And it truly is the View of 1,000 Peaks. So I think that was a big part of it. And then the other part of it was just the vertical and, you know, opening up parts of Tate and Bowl, which was some former heli ski terrain, and really bringing it to the next level in terms of a big mountain experience.
Did you start to see a different mix of skiers? Panorama has that reputation as a very good intermediate and family mountain. As you opened some of that black terrain off the top, did you start to see more interest from maybe the more advanced skiers?
No, absolutely. And, you know, the other part of it tied back to IntraWest was now you've got a family of resorts. So you've got some folks coming from the West Coast, but it really started to open up the East Coast more with folks coming out of Tremblant, obviously a part of the IntraWest group and Blue Mountain, and working with SkiCan out of Ontario, bringing a lot of charters this way. And, you know, that look at the Ontario and Quebec market are important to Canada and certainly, you know, North America. Well-traveled, and don't let the less vertical fool you. They're incredibly great skiers and they're looking for big mountain experiences. And, you know, I think it started to really open up Panorama by having, you know, more vertical. The other thing I do want to give credit to in terms of IntraWest is the people first and foremost. And, you know, Dave Brownlee was a huge part of Whistler Blackcomb for a number of years, but they actually had Dave oversee Panorama for a lot of years. So, you know, he was a big part of that early vision and, you know, certainly bringing a lot of the Blackcomb and Whistler ideas and culture to Panorama. And, you know, some of that is certainly still here today.
Yeah, certainly a big part of that culture and what they were building at Whistler was a village. And that was one of the things that IntraWest was really known for, was real estate, building villages. What did those elements of the resort look like when IntraWest arrived in 93? And it sounds like from what you're telling me, there was already the seeds of that in place. But how did IntraWest evolve that? How fast did all that change?
It happened relatively quickly. You know, the condo hotel market was really, really popular at the time. IntraWest, you know, on their real estate and development side were exceptionally good at that. Some phenomenal people, pioneers, you know, Gary Raymond led the real estate side of it and a whole bunch of other people, just, you know, amazing, amazing group of people. So when they launched Ski Tip, which was the first condo hotel, there was a lottery, a real estate lottery actually in Calgary. And, you know, people were lined up around the block to get in on it. And then that momentum just continued from there. And it really, truly is. I mean, the Upper Village even the lower villages connected with a ski bridge, you know, truly is ski in, ski out, and then putting that amenity of the Springs Pool in at the base of the mountain, I think was brilliant and certainly, you know, a game changer for the resort as well. So the condo hotel market created a village for the resort, created a bigger lodging platform for the resort, and certainly, you know, complemented what was there with respect to the lower village, which was more townhome type product. And then they went on to actually blend in some more townhomes as well. The other thing that started in the kind of mid-90s, which is, you know, an iconic part of, it's a jewel in the crown for Panorama, is Grey Wolf Golf Course. Mm-hmm. So that is, you know, ranked number one in Western Canada. It's in the top 10 in Canada. And I have to give not only IntraWest, but, you know, the folks here at Panorama at the time, huge credit for having, you know, the vision to layer that in as part of the amenities and the attraction of the resort. And again, the surrounding mountains make it one of the best mountainside courses in North America.
So while all these changes are happening, it seems like you're working your way up through the organization, and you can fill us in as much as you want on what you were doing during those years. But in 1999, you had the opportunity to go run another IntraWest resort, which was Mont Sainte-Marie in Quebec. How did that opportunity come up, Steve? And how did that appeal to you? How did you decide it was time to make a change and move across the country again?
Yeah, well, maybe just taking a little bit of a step back, I decided at that point I wanted to further some education and sharpen the saw, so to speak, and enrolled in a MBA program. You know, obviously at that time to go do an MBA, you physically have to move to a city somewhere and physically attend. And I just didn't really want to leave the industry or leave, you know, my career progression at the time, and started searching, you know, hard for something, and found, you know, one of the first remote learning programs, which are now all over the world with every major university. But here in Alberta at Athabasca University, there were innovators in having one of the first programs like that, a master's program like that. And I enrolled in that program. At the same time, a friend of mine owned a chalet at a ski area in British Columbia here called Mount Baldy, which had been pretty much defunct and non-operational for about 5 years. And he said, you know, this would be a great thing for me to do. So kind of started thinking about that and doing my MBA. And I thought, yeah, maybe that is a cool thing to do. So we actually got resurrected and operational again. And while we were doing that, I certainly stayed in touch with colleagues from IntraWest. And finally, one day I got a call and they said, look, we're looking to continue to expand our portfolio of resorts. And we've got this resort called Mont Sainte-Marie. And would you be interested in going to West Quebec and operating this resort? But, you know, you got to land the job first. And I said, you know what? Absolutely. Let's take a look at it. And I have to give credit to Charles Blier, you know, a great guy in the industry, now back at Camelback. And I had not met Charles prior to going out to West Quebec. Anyway, Charles had narrowed down his list of candidates, and IntraWest said, hey, you know, we want you to chat with Steve. He's jumping on a plane. He's heading your way. And, you know, reminiscing about that time with Charles, he says, you know, you really weren't on the list. I had these candidates, but I arrived and we sat down and had a long, interesting conversation. And he decided, you know what, you're actually the one I want to choose for Mont Sainte-Marie. So as they say, the rest is history. I had the opportunity to go there, had not lived in the East before. As I said, you know, grew up in Vancouver and spent, you know, all my time mostly here in the West, but it was absolutely exceptional. You know, the resort is actually Mont Sainte-Marie, steeped in history. Very, very famous early pioneer named Johnny Clifford, who had founded the area. And then, you know, to grow it, they actually had a Swiss group come in and invest a lot of money to grow it. And then they had some difficult times. And, you know, eventually IntraWest saw the opportunity there and picked up that resort. But just many generations of families in that part of Quebec in Lac Sainte-Marie that have worked for the area and somewhat all, you know, related. And here I am, this Westerner coming in. And, you know, the first thing, I took some French lessons in high school in Vancouver, but not really thinking about my future in terms of speaking French. I'm still not very good at it, but started taking French lessons again. Went to the Berlitz Language School in Ottawa, went down every Friday, spent about 6 to 8 hours trying to learn French again. And the folks, when they saw that, you know, in that community and it's part of the culture, and those that worked at the ski area, when they saw that I was making that effort, I think it made a huge difference. And I genuinely cared about their culture and the history and the background there, and embraced that. And they saw that. And I think that made a huge difference. And then we were, you know, injecting some dollars into it, but it was a smaller resort, and they were, InterWest was focused on Tremblant's growth, which was exceptional, in Blue Mountain, and starting to pull more resorts into the portfolio. But as a younger general manager, newly minted, and part of that group, I remember them saying, well, you know, you're all set up. Here you go. You got about a $300,000 line of credit at the local bank. Don't call home. And, you know, off you go. But an amazing support network of people, you know, over at Tremblant was Roger McCarthy, who I started reporting to, being in that part of the country, and just some phenomenal people that supported you along the way. So it was a great experience. I really, really think fondly of it.
So Mont Saint-Marie, good little mountain. I've skied there. Actually, I was there in 2002, so probably when you were out of the place. Yeah. Nice little mountain, but it's little and maybe didn't fit into InterWest long-term plans. In 2002, they ended up selling the ski area. What can you tell us about why?
Yeah, I can tell you why we made that decision. I will say it's the highest vertical east of the Rockies, the first highest vertical east of the Rockies. So they take a lot of pride in that. And, you know, I'll also say that those skiers are important as feeder areas for all the rest of the larger areas. And some great skiers that come out of there. Dustin Cook came out of Mont Saint-Marie on the Canadian national team. But the decision to sell it, really, it came down to growing the portfolio. And I was, again, just fortunate to be asked to be a part of some of the M&A stuff that was going on with InterWest. And at the time, they were starting to expand the portfolio in Colorado. So still at Mont Saint-Marie, but had the opportunity to go down to Colorado and be a part of putting Winter Park into the stable of resorts. And so we were down there doing some due diligence on it. And great resort, by the way. And, you know, I think it was on the way home in the airport, where they literally sort of doing the back of the napkin stuff. And they said, I think we're going to have to divest Mont Saint-Marie. You know, you've taken it a long ways and it's in great shape. And do you think you can find a buyer for it? And I said, yeah, I think locally in that region, I think I can. It would be great for somebody else's portfolio. So we did that and put it together, and we're able to divest it and continue to grow with some other resorts coming into the portfolio for InterWest.
How did you feel about that personally, Steve? Because you kind of built the place up, and I'd imagine it developed an attachment to the community and to the mountain and to the culture. Did you have any urge to stay at Mont Saint-Marie, or was it clear that InterWest was your future?
Well, I mean, my loyalty to InterWest at the time was huge, and I still felt there was lots to do, and you make such great connections and friends with peers and colleagues in an organization like that. But I think, you know, for any one of us, having this, you know, role and being able to work with people to grow these resorts, you get emotionally attached. And I will say, even today, you know, the friendships that I was fortunate to forge there are lifelong. And people like Charles Blier, you know, just a great mentor, a great lifelong friend, and the connection with that small rural community. You start to get to know all your employees, you get to know their families, you get to know the history. You're part of taking the history and blending it into the story, and certainly the, you know, the fabric of the resort. So it's emotional. You really, you know, it weighs on you, and you feel bad leaving them behind, but we left them in great hands. It was the group from Camp Fortune that purchased it, and great operators, and certainly in good hands. But I wasn't prepared to leave the InterWest family, the culture, the people, and knew there was great opportunities ahead, and came back to Panorama. Actually, you know, it was going through that rapid growth with the lodging side of the business and the real estate side of the business. And so, you know, came back and really focused on the lodging side of the business, the guest experience side. And the other part of the equation during that time was the homeowners. Newly minted, brand new condo homeowners excited about being a part of the resort. And that was happening everywhere throughout, you know, throughout the industry. So putting together a homeowner relations program and starting to build that connectivity in terms of relationship with the homeowners and the resort. And I think that was critically important. And I think somewhat new and innovative at the time.
So you'd gone off and helped resurrect Mount Baldy, which is still going today, I'm happy to say. When ran Mont Saint Marie, I mean, how much had Panorama changed in those few years that you were gone?
Well, transformational. I mean, it was to come back and see the six blocks of condo hotels coming into their own, the new lift infrastructure that was put into place. Obviously, Grey Wolf now was really, you know, humming along, summer business growing. You know, it was great, absolutely phenomenal to see that transformation and that next chapter in its life and in its history.
So the big modernization in Panorama's lift fleet really came in 2003 when the Champagne Express Quad replaced the Horizon Double Chair and the Champagne T-Bar, and the Fixed Grip Summit Quad replaced the Summit T-Bar. Just curious from your point of view as someone who had been skiing there for 15 years at that point, how much did that change the character of the mountain in a positive way?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, again, I have to give Dave Brownlee and that group a lot of credit for making that happen. But I think, you know, it takes it into a different realm of a true destination resort, big mountain resort. You know, you're going from surface lifts to quads, you know, chairlifts. And I think that gives it a new identity. It certainly repositions it in the marketplace, and it allows skiers access and boarders access to terrain that wasn't there before. You know, they were starting to open up some frontside terrain and certainly looking at a little bit more in terms of what could happen with Tate and Bowl.
Yeah, when you put in new lifts like that, this was, you know, 20 years ago that we didn't have social media. How long did that take to really settle in with skiers that this was not a mountain where you had to take two T-bars to the top anymore? This was, you could ride too fast, a sequence of high-speed quads out of the base, get on a fixed quad to the summit, and be there without all the hanging out and dragging around.
Yeah, I think, you know, the ski shows were critically important to get that message out there. And, you know, at that time, going to the ski show to see what's new. I mean, Panorama certainly had a what's new. And that was a exciting thing to talk about for the marketers to go into the major ski shows and do that. Again, being a part of that Intra-West network of resorts, you know, they were incredibly savvy at getting that message out. So it did anchor it and position it as a true destination resort.
So you weren't at Panorama for long on this stop. Another big Intra-West property now owned by Powder Corp is Copper Mountain in Colorado. And you were named president and general manager of that major Summit County resort in 2003. Copper, I think, is an interesting combination of Panorama's size and Mount St. Marie's busyness. How did your time at those two resorts prepare you to run Copper, which is one of the busier ski areas in the country?
Yeah, I mean, it was exciting to be able to go there and be a part of that. You know, David Berry had really transformed the area with the planners and certainly having Intra-West now in that hyper-competitive, you know, Summit County area was game-changing. I think the past wars at the time were at their peak, and the resort was under tremendous amount of growth and expansion. Again, you know, I think the opportunity to go there at a young age and be a part of that, really, you know, the experiences, you know, I brought there were around people and community. First and foremost, you know, Copper Mountain has a great history with Chuck Lewis. And, you know, when I got there, I was, you know, introduced to people that had been there since day one. Large number of staff, you know, 3,000 employees. And again, you know, a very hyper-competitive environment with, you know, Breckenridge and Keystone and Arapahoe Basin and Vail and Beaver Creek just to the west of us. So learned a ton. I mean, great again, a network of people in IntraWest. And I think the thing that was most important for me there was the people and being able to embrace the culture. And I remember us saying we were kind of like the skinny kid in the sandbox. You know, we were more independent in that stable of all the other resorts around us. So, you know, the marketing team did a great job to differentiate things. I think the development team built a great village there. You know, the Burning Stones Plaza was something new and differentiated at the time. And again, just having that network of IntraWest people and the culture was phenomenal.
So Colorado is the epicenter, right? Just of North American skiing. It's one out of every four skier visits in the United States is in Colorado. And it's kind of the place that a lot of people think of as arriving. And it sounds like you had a great time there and hung around. Nonetheless, in 2007, you got this great opportunity to go run Kicking Horse, super unique, super cool ski area. But that means that you had to make the decision to leave IntraWest after 14 years. Sounds like you really enjoyed that time. What were the factors that you considered when this Kicking Horse opportunity came along? And ultimately, why did you decide that was the right decision?
Well, in around 2006, I remember vividly IntraWest continuously wanting to grow and expand, you know, starting to look at other opportunities and more diversified opportunities in hotel and spa and different things. You know, they had gone, you know, into the market with Goldman Sachs looking to raise more equity. And, you know, the interesting thing that happened there was Fortress came along and decided they loved the story. They loved IntraWest in terms of the portfolio and certainly all these different branded resorts, and they bought it. It sold. I think, you know, for me personally, it was starting to look like, you know, the culture was going to shift as a whole and change. And so the opportunity after they had sold IntraWest as a whole, for me, came about sort of looking at different things out there. And there was a group out of the Netherlands called Ballast Natum that had started Kicking Horse Mountain Resort, you know, one of the first real new resorts in North America at the time. And so I reached out to a colleague who certainly knew of them, and they said, you know, they're actually looking for a CEO. They're looking for somebody who really understands the industry and, you know, somebody from North America to help guide them and certainly help grow the vision for Kicking Horse. So I went over to the Netherlands and spent a week there with Ballast Natum and their CEO and some other senior executives from that group, and quickly, you know, realized that these folks were very, very serious about what they were doing. Definitely, you know, well-funded at the time. And, you know, it was a 150-year-old company in the Netherlands and very steeped in tradition, very steeped in culture. And it resonated well with me. Again, you know, the people side of it, the culture side of it, it felt like it was a great group. But also, I grew up in British Columbia and grew up very familiar with these mountains and, you know, looking at it as an exciting new, somewhat of a greenfield resort. What better opportunity than to come back to Canada and certainly British Columbia and back home for that matter. So it was a pretty quick decision. My oldest son was born in Vail at the little hospital at the base of the mountain. And my wife and I sort of packed everything up and came back to British Columbia. Kicking Horse is a phenomenal resort. The vertical there, the natural terrain, the snow, it's a little different than most other areas. Fell in love with that resort again. Had, you know, a master plan that was the original master plan, but worked incredibly hard with a great group of people, some former IntraWest colleagues, a gentleman by the name of Bill Green, who was very instrumental in Tremblant and Blue Mountain with IntraWest, had since left as well. Many folks had left after the sale in 2006. Anyway, worked with Bill and EcoSign again, and were able to work with the province of British Columbia and take it from 1,900 bed units approved in the original master plan to 20,000 bed units approved, and an expanded CRA, controlled recreation area. And so that, you know, really created a great platform for future growth. You know, the unfortunate reality with Kicking Horse, for me anyway, at the time, was 2008 had rolled around and it was, you know, that global financial crisis. And with the parent company, Ballast/Natum, back in the Netherlands, they were an international infrastructure company doing some phenomenal projects all over the world. It impacted them and they looked at the resort in terms of their portfolio and said, you know, I think it's time for us to divest this and put it into some different hands of folks that, you know, that really is their passion and their where the energy will lie. So we work with Rothschilds out of the UK to put together a short list of those groups that might be interested in Kicking Horse. You know, had a great master plan, certainly great natural terrain and vertical. And it didn't take long for resorts of the Canadian Rockies, just given that they had a portfolio of resorts in both Alberta and British Columbia, to really take a hard, serious look at it. So that came together rather quickly. And, you know, it's now part of the Resorts of the Canadian Rockies RCR group.
So you found yourself working under a different ski conglomerate. Just curious to get your perspective here on what your time was like at Resorts of the Canadian Rockies and how that was similar to and different from your time with Interwest.
Well, the one thing I would say with RCR is it's actually less corporate than you might think, but more of a family-based culture that has a strong bond with a very hardworking, dedicated group of industry leaders that are deeply rooted in Canada. You know, many of their senior leaders at RCR have been with RCR for decades, and it really truly is a close family network of people that are very dedicated to, you know, their brands. It was fun. I mean, they were a great group of folks to work with. At the same time, as you know, I'd worked probably for about a year post the sale of the resort. There was a group of local folks that were really, really passionate about Panorama. They owned homes here, successful business leaders out of BC and Alberta. And they were looking to purchase back Panorama Mountain Resort from Intrawest, move down that path, did that, and were looking for a CEO to help, again, you know, lead the vision and the future of the resort. And they had reached out to some former Intrawest colleagues and said, you know, who do you know out there that would be a great candidate for us? And my name popped up pretty quickly and they phoned me and said, hey, would you be interested in meeting us for lunch? So that lunch turned into a very long lunch and then a very long dinner. And by the end of the night, you know, for me and in my heart and in my head, it was what a great opportunity to really come full circle. And sometimes you got to go around the globe to come back home. And this was that opportunity some 11 years ago. And just sitting here today and looking back, it seems somewhat surreal at times, but it's just been amazing. And in my heart of hearts, I'm looking forward to the next 10 years.
So you've had a decade to really get to know and work with this ownership group. What can you tell us, Steve? Because in some cases, it's easy to figure out who owns a ski area. You know, Vail owns a bunch of them. Alterra owns a bunch. Powder owns a bunch. But sometimes when it's a group of folks, it's a little more opaque. So what can you tell us about who owns Panorama? And I'm curious, long term, if you get the sense that they're committed to keeping this place independent.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I can say it's a small group of folks that are first and foremost homeowners on the resort here. Their primary residences are mostly in Alberta and Calgary, but they own homes here. Some of them have owned homes here for decades and even since the early days of the late 70s. So they're passionate about the resort. They've raised their families here. Grandkids are part of that equation as well. And they're skiers. They're really passionate about skiing as well. And so, you know, it's a small group, very independent, but I'll also say that, you know, that group, they're certainly accomplished business people, you know, have had a long history of being in business. So they understand business, you know, and for me at this stage in my life and career, it's probably been one of the best groups I've ever worked with. You know, we have a strong business rhythm, a process around that. We meet quarterly, and you know, we're always in contact with each other, and I'm exceptionally good at making sure that there's no surprises, and we chat back and forth. But you know, it certainly has a strong business discipline and a strong business culture, and they've been nothing but phenomenal to work with. I feel very fortunate to be a part of that group. In terms of independence, we say we're fiercely independent. Part of our branding is, you know, pure Canada. But also we look to the future of the resort, and, you know, obviously being a part of Icon Mountain Collective has been a huge part of, you know, our growth and certainly opening up different parts of the market. But, you know, the master plan that we have today is absolutely exceptional. And as I said earlier, we've got 200 acres of undeveloped ski in, ski out, in some areas just steps away, future development. And it has to be balanced with the mountain itself in terms of lift infrastructure. So, you know, we're looking to our future now, and I would say we are definitely interested in chatting with a developer or maybe a few developers out there, North America-wide, that would want to be part of this journey and sharing that vision going forward for Panorama. It's an exciting master plan. It's a fully approved master plan with an official community plan. And we're really, you know, the last 10 years, we've focused hard on guest experience, employee experience, core product, grooming, summer glading, snowmaking expansion. This summer, we're putting in our first mountain coaster, an aerial park. We're just finishing a development of 52 ski-in townhomes. But I would say we are looking to our future, and we would entertain the idea of chatting with a developer that wants to work with us and sharing that vision for the future.
So when you say a developer, do you mean an additional investor or a buyer?
Well, I don't think at this point, no, we're not looking for a buyer. I think we're quite happy with how we're structured. But in terms of a proven developer investor, an opportunity to work with them and share in that vision. Part of that vision is finishing what I call the hug around the base of the mountain and around the current village. And, you know, in that upper village here, we've got, I would say, some of the best true ski in, ski out, future real estate yet to be developed. Part of the vision for that is we're really ripe now for a true full service hotel. Like, you can literally ski into the lobby of what we've got planned here. So, you know, 120, 130 room, full service hotel, spa, meeting space, great food and beverage amenities. I think that really is going to round it out. And then surrounding that jewel in the crown is, I think, some more condo hotels and some mixed commercial and some other amenities around that for people to enjoy both in summer and winter. So I'm really excited about that. Working again with EcoSign on that master plan, you know, it really is that continuum of what, you know, Interwest started back in the early 90s. But the balance of the mountain, that symbiotic relationship with the mountain and the village is critical. So that's all part of it. So as we look to our future, you know, we had one of the first, at the time, new and innovative, you know, quad chairs, Doppelmayr high-speed quad called the Mile One, which replaced the long historic T-bar out of the village here. And, you know, that was put in 89. I have to give full credit to our maintenance teams, electrical teams. You know, they do an exceptional job of, you know, making sure all of our lifts are well-maintained and certainly safe. But, you know, all the things come to an end. And, you know, that would be, you know, one of the first lifts that we would certainly replace and upgrade. The vision there is to put in a six pack and maybe even a combination of chandala. So combination, mostly chairs, but maybe some gondola cabins. And the reason being is once you get to the top of that, you know, another vision for the future is to have a true gondola right to the summit. And so that not only changes, you know, how skiers move around and get to the summit. And then, you know, one of the things we did not too long ago is we further expanded Tatton Bowl. So it's over 1,000 acres of big mountain skiing back there serviced by these cats. And we've done systematically a lot of glading year over year. So it's great big mountain former heli skiing terrain, but that gondola off the new lift to the summit would certainly change some things. But the sightseeing opportunity for this part of Canada to be able to see those view of 1,000 peaks and the Rocky Mountains and the Purcells from the summit in the summertime, we believe would be absolutely spectacular. So there's that. We're looking to the west of us, Sun Bowl. There's a future lift plan for there. That's great natural terrain. It loads up with a lot of natural snow. We've got a learning center visioned for that area as well. So you're able to come out of the base area up into Sun Bowl, ski that great terrain, which the reason it's called Sun Bowl, it gets a lot of, great sunshine. And it's really, bread and butter terrain, great intermediate family terrain, generational, grandparents can be in there with grandkids. And then having a learning center facility in that area, I think would be something very special for that area. And then looking to the east, Founders, that's where the bulk of the future development of neighborhoods and real estate is. Again, we've got, about 50 acres of true ski and ski out land that we own there. It's all been visioned, through the master plan. And then there would be a lift coming out of that Founders area, that Founders neighborhood, certainly being serviced in that area. With the end in mind, the master plan really looks, out 40 years. An area called Goldie would be, again, all of this is within our controlled recreation area. An area called Goldie would have another lift. And then Tegan does have a lift as part of the future lift plans in it. But the experience of being able to get in the passenger cats and go along the ridgeline or even hike the ridgeline, it's not uncommon. People enjoy that and just having that experience there. I think it's serving us well for now. But, there is a future lift as part of the master plan for that area. But for now, these passenger cats and they're brand new cats that we've had custom made. The cabins are brand new and custom made. They're a great experience.
Gosh, there's so much exciting stuff in there that we could drill into, Steve. I want to focus for now on that potential mile one lift replacement. Were you saying that you could see a mile one replacement actually being a gondola all the way to the summit? Or if you did a chondola, it would connect to another gondola that would go to the summit? I mean, are you actually thinking about a lift that goes fully top to bottom here?
No, I think, as part of the evolution of planning and the hindsight, in that for us is having long gondolas to summits is happening and has happened all around us. I mean, I've had many trips to Europe and into Austria and France and the Dolomites of Italy, but, certainly into Austria, it's just awe-inspiring to see the lift systems there. And where they say you can't put a lift, just go to Austria and have a look around. I mean, it's amazing what they can do and what they have down there. I think when I look at it today, and this is just really, more about the future and planning, is to have it split, I think, has some advantages. If you get some inclement weather and some heavy winds, the whole lift system can be compromised and certainly shut down. I think having the variability, at least for us, and the vision for Panorama in terms of some of the future lift infrastructure, having that variability and the ability to perhaps shut that gondola from mid-mountain to the summit if there was inclement weather, high winds, whatever, I think is valuable to have. And you don't have all the sunk cost right out of the gate with one rather significant and large lift. We certainly don't need that. I think, to prioritize lifts down the road here, the mile one would be the first one, and just replacing it pretty much in its current profile is the best thing for us into the future.
And then would you think of a gondola maybe from there up to the summit, maybe alongside the current lifts?
Yeah, if you're looking from the base of the mountain up to the right is the mile one, and you think of that as pretty much the profile of a new lift, just a one-for-one there. When you unload a little bit to the left, it would be the future load area for a potential gondola to the summit.
And of the three lifts that are in the master plan, there's a Tain Bowl lift, there's a Sun Bowl lift, there's a Hopeful Creek lift. Which of the three of those would be your priority as far as which you would like to get built next?
Well, certainly the mile one, a replacement of that. And then I think, you know, something in Sun Bowl, and this has to go parallel to our real estate development and growth. So, you know, we would grow some more skier visits through warm beds and real estate development. And then that Sun Bowl lift, I think, would be a next lift, you know, after mile one. And then looking at Founders, again, you know, tied to real estate, that's where, you know, that third lift will go. Hopeful in hindsight now, I think is way out there, you know, a number of years out there. I think a gondola to the summit down the road, again, once that critical mass comes around in terms of future real estate and really driven by market demand, would be interesting and a differentiator for Panorama Mountain Resort and really opening up more and more of the summer market. And then Goldie, that would be a big piece of terrain expansion within the controlled recreation area. So the controlled recreation area is quite expansive. It's even larger than the somewhat 3,000 acres of skiable terrain. So we've got lots of terrain in terms of future expansion, certainly lots of vertical. And with the 200 acres of fee simple land that we own today with a real estate master plan tied to that, we really have our vision well anchored and well set. And, you know, it will really be dependent on how we balance the growth of real estate with skier visit growth.
I want to focus on Tain Bowl for a minute before we move on here, Steve. This is really a whole different level of terrain than what Panorama had traditionally been known for. And we talked a little bit earlier about some of those black diamonds off the summit, but this is just a really expansive piece of terrain. Doesn't sound like you're in a big hurry to get a lift over there, but just talk about the importance of that terrain to Panorama long-term, just perception-wise, and just given what your competitive landscape looks like with places like Kicking Horse and Fernie and Revelstoke, how important it is to have a terrain pod like that where folks know they're going to get that big, open, exposed, steep, big mountain experience.
Yeah, I think you said it right there. It's about big mountain experience. And Panorama has traditionally, you know, had a great history and reputation for phenomenal intermediate terrain, great fall line skiing, good vertical, long history of ski racing here, alpine ski racing. And as things evolved and certainly technology and equipment evolved, you know, wider skis, you know, more all mountain type of skis. And I think even the sport itself, when people grow up ski racing and we embrace it, like I said, we've got the NORAM championships here and we've done the World Juniors here. And, you know, we're looking to our future with other races. But even like my own kids, you know, they evolve and they want to go explore things, whether it be side country or get on different gear. And so when I was looking at the resort some 10, 11 years ago, I looked at the base area and I looked at the beginner terrain and it was well done. But, you know, I think there was a greater opportunity to connect and create a balanced, you know, resort of beginner to complement that all that intermediate. And then the big mountain experience, you know, Tain Bowl was really only about a portion of Tain Bowl. It wasn't all of Tain Bowl. So, you know, started to do an amendment to the master plan and look at taking, why have half a bowl? You know, let's take the entire bowl and then some. And it really made sense, most importantly from a safety standpoint, where people, you know, were venturing past the rope line more because they could see it. It was there. It was, you know, the rest of the bowl was there, but it wasn't within our controlled recreation area. So It was a combination of safety first and foremost. You know, it's big mountain skiing, tons of natural snow in the area, and then repositioning, rebranding Panorama Mountain Resort as a big mountain experience, big mountain resort. So that was critically important, as well as that beginner terrain. You know, that's why we put in that Discovery quad lift, so that we had people being able to transition from never evers, you know, putting in some more carpets right at the toe of the slope and having them transition onto a lift and then eventually the intermediate terrain. And then that big mountain terrain, I think, was a significant move in terms of positioning Panorama Mountain Resort into that big mountain experience. And it's been phenomenal. In the summers, year over year, we've gone in and made sure we, you know, cleaned up a lot of the deadfall opened up some more lines at the bottom of, you know, some of the big runs to make sure that, you know, they weren't bottlenecked, and did some selective blading in there to make that experience better and better. And then putting these two passenger cats into the monster terrain, Jekyll and Hyde, I think is, you know, when people discover that and certainly experience it, it's differentiated.
Do you charge for that, or are the cats just part of the lift ticket?
No, we charge for it. You can buy a season's pass add-on for that, and many do. That's most popular. And then, you know, those that are here on, you know, a day ticket, or certainly, you know, Icon or Mountain Collective, they buy an add-on to that, and it's really cool. You've got to come and experience that sort.
So lots of terrain variety and lots of terrain, period. There are big sections of the trail map, Steve, that are blocked off in purple. And I think this relates to your efforts around white bark pine conservation. And Panorama is actually a leader in this. The White Bark Pine Ecosystem Foundation of Canada certified your mountain as a, quote, white bark pine friendly ski area, end quote. What does that mean, Steve? And how did Panorama earn that designation?
Sure. Well, I'll say that the group here, the team here on the mountain operations side, has been doing this for the better part of the last 25 years. So they've been collecting, you know, working with a local university to collect the cones. And by collecting those cones, they're able to really understand and study why some of the white bark pine is disease resistant and why some of the others may get diseased from time to time. So they've been innovators in doing this for a number of years. But yeah, we were designated one of the first in Canada to be white bark pine friendly. So that was just, I think, a huge recognition to have that certification for the group, knowing they've been doing this for, you know, the better part of the last 25 years. So I think for them, there was a tremendous amount of pride when they've got that certification and that designation. You know, in terms of the area that you're speaking about being hatched off, that was purposely done. We've put 5,000 pine seedlings into that area. We planted 5,000 future white bark pine trees in that area, and of created, you know, a designated area on the resort. I mean, there's many white bark pine in the alpine, and we certainly work hard to make sure that we protect those for the wildlife and certainly for the future. But this one area that you're speaking about, we purposely have designated that as a protected area with 5,000 new seedlings in that area. And we'll continue to do that going forward, working with the province of British Columbia, and we'll continue on with the great work that the team here is doing.
Is this in some ways a real-time science experiment, Steve, where you're planting these 5,000 seedlings, you're monitoring which ones are disease-resistant, and then maybe collecting the pine cones from those and distributing them to other areas that have been decimated?
Yeah, I think at this point, we're not bringing them to other areas. I think what the cone collection team is doing is maybe preserving those in some sort of a bank, a cone bank for now, and, you know, continuously sort of looking at what can be done to protect the white bark pine, not only here, but in other areas. But, I mean, that's an interesting idea, something that, you know, I'll certainly take back to the folks and see what their thoughts are around it. But for now, it's really collecting those to study them and also put them into some sort of a bank for now.
So for skiers looking at this, these big chunks of terrain that they can't access, is the idea that these are fenced off forever, sort of permanently protected, or are you letting the trees mature and at a future time, maybe this could be a tree skiing zone?
I think for now, absolutely, it's protected. And, you know, the white bark pine takes a long time to establish and grow. So we want to make sure that it's given that opportunity. We've got so much terrain out there. I don't see us going in that direction in the future. It's really about doing the right thing and making sure that we allow these trees time to mature.
Well, it's good work and worthy cause. Steve, with that, I will let you go. I cannot thank you enough for all of your time today. I know you've still got a couple more weeks of winter here left. So I appreciate you lending your time to me during this busy season. I hope for the best for Panorama, and great talking to you. Great catching up.
Stuart, thanks so much. And wishing all of my colleagues out there throughout North America all the best.
That's Steve Pakinyan, president and CEO of Panorama Mountain BC. That was awesome, Steve. How cool to hear from someone who started at Panorama and ended up running the place. Really, really awesome story. Thank you so much for sharing that. I hope you all enjoyed that as much as I did. Thank you all for listening. Like I said, I am hitting BC hard this year. If you missed my conversation with Red Mountain CEO Howard Katkov, go check that out to start. And look for episodes later this year with the leaders of Cypress, Whistler, and Fernie. Don't worry, America, I have a bunch coming for you too. But really, you all gotta go ski BC if you haven't already. To get new podcasts the moment they're alive, please visit stormskiing.com and subscribe to the Storm Skiing newsletter. New pods appear in your email box several hours before syncing with the podcast services, including Apple and Spotify. There are free and paid tiers of newsletter, and paid subscribers always receive podcasts 7 full days before everyone else. You can also follow The Storm on Twitter and Instagram at @StormSkiJournal. Until next time, stay well, stay safe. I'm Stuart Winchester, and I'll talk to you again very soon.
The Storm Skiing Podcast is a Quicksilver Films production.